Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, coming to you live from Rochester, New York. Thanks for joining me this evening. A little bit late. That's entirely my fault because I forgot to let my producer know exactly who I was going to be interviewing this evening, and he thought we were still at the Roswell Conference. So we are going to be discussing the Roswell Conference this evening. Tonight I've got Peter Robbins joining me, who acted as MC in Roswell, and also my husband, Rich Dolan. If any of you haven't heard of Rich yet, he's the author of UFOs in the National Security State. I can't believe that anyone's listening to my show and hasn't heard me talk about Rich yet. So we have decided, since Rich, Peter, and I did this last month, we got together and discussed UFO news, and we also talked about the Roswell Conference at that time, which was coming up. And we got so much positive feedback that we've decided we're going to make this a regular event. So I think probably once a month or so, the three of us will get together and talk about what's new.
I think it's a great idea, Karen.
Cool. Peter, are you with us?
I am indeed, and I think it's a great idea, too. Hi, you guys.
Thank you so much for joining
us. Hello,
Peter.
My pleasure. I feel like I just saw you. Well, I did. That's why. Well,
yeah, we did.
I don't know about you guys. I'm just still a little bit punchy from all the traveling and all of the input and excitement and interesting things that covered last week.
Punchy. That's
punchy.
The word.
That's a great word.
On the rope.
And, you know, I haven't told you, actually, when we were driving back from Roswell to Albuquerque on our way out of town, Rich was driving, and all of a sudden he said, "Oh, my God, did you see that spider?" Like crossing the road, and I'm thinking, what kind of spider would be large enough to see?
It was about as big as a child's hand. It was a large spider.
And I'm thinking, oh my God, we're in the Southwest. It was a tarantula. Thank you, Lord, for not letting me see that, because I have this thing. You know how everybody has some thing that they really hate?
Oh, yours is large, hairy spiders and spiders in general.
Black tarantula, that's exactly what it was.
Oh.
I mean, in a way, I'm thinking, wow, that was pretty cool, and I'm sort of sorry I missed it, but overall, no, I'm very happy that I didn't see it.
I think when insects are larger than 6 inches or so, it's God showing that he has a sense of humor.
I think anything over 3 inches is really icky. I'm sorry, I can't.
Well, it's bigger than quite a number of animals, and I actually have a soft spot in my heart for large tarantula spiders. Don't ask me why. Maybe it was seeing that movie Tarantula as a child, one of the great B movies. I think it actually occurred near Roswell, where they're exposed to a great amount of radioactivity. And then some bad special effects, and we have giant spiders jumping around.
Oh.
Yikes.
And why did I miss that movie? Gosh.
Well, it came out, I think you were born or about that time, so you might have been, you know, as a baby, your parents probably took you, but you don't remember.
No. My parents don't like spiders any more than I do, so I don't.
Ah, well, there you go. They didn't take you to that movie then.
No.
I don't think I saw that one.
It is called
Tarantula.
And
Tarantula
reprised as a send-up a few years ago in a great newbie movie called Eight-Legged Freaks.
What a wonderful title.
Yeah, I mean, we're off on a tangent here, but we've just come from the mysterious Southwest, so it's totally appropriate, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This is what people get for encouraging three friends to get together every month and chat.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And
bad idea.
See for the next hour and a half, folks, so get a cup of tea and settle down.
So, what are we, do we want to start with here, guys?
Well, I would like to talk a bit about the Roswell Festival, because, you know, a lot of people who are listening now or who will be listening to the archive shows did not get to go to Roswell.
Right.
So, what was everybody's most fun thing in Roswell? I mean, the talks were phenomenal. I mean, Rich, you gave a really wonderful one, again.
Thanks.
Yes, and it is the one I didn't see, but I have been told I'm going to get a full set of the DVDs, so I will watch it the privacy of my home, and very much looking forward to it.
It's
indeed.
A private kind of experience, anyway. So that's
seriously,
it's a talk that I've been evolving throughout this 2008. I called it the challenges of UFO disclosure, and I've given it a number of times earlier this year at different venues. And without going on and on about this, but my basic theme was I was trying to think about the real concrete results of what would happen with an actual official disclosure about UFO reality. I mean, it's very typical for most people to talk about this and say how important it is, how necessary it is, and I certainly believe in it. But, you know, there are obstacles against it, and there are, in my view, real hurdles for us to overcome before and after this disclosure is made. For example, how, if you're in a position of power in this society, in this civilization of ours, how do you actually give this secret up without endangering your own position? And, I mean, it's easy for plebs like us to say, you know, release a secret, we need to know the truth. But if you're in a position where you've actually been complicit to some extent in a lie for many, many years or generations, it's not easy. And if you yourself, as, say, the president, are not complicit after all those years, but there may be other interests, other powerful interests who are in the mix here, and they certainly would not favor that. So there's a lot of these issues going on. There's economic, financialist interests involved, all kinds of social and psychological interests as well. I mean, how really would people react?
I think it'll be a lot harder for people hearing the truth than they realize, too. I mean, it's very easy to say, I want to know what's happening. Tell me. I can take it. And I'm not saying people can't take it, but I'm thinking it's entirely possible that they don't realize how tough it's going to be.
I think that's right, Karen. There are. I was just reading the other day, I was doing some research on crop circles. I actually gave a local presentation on that the other day here in Rochester, believe it or not.
We go to one of those meetup groups.
Cool.
Yeah, do you know what these are?
A meetup group here in Rochester, and it's really fun.
It's like 20, 25 people who go to this. But in any case, I read a story about Andrew Lloyd Webber. Listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1995, Andrew Webber, he had an estate in England, in southwestern England. And it turns out he was a very strong skeptic on the whole matter of crop circles. So one morning, he is told by someone who works on his estate that a glyph or a circle has appeared on his property. And he said, well, I want you to go out and find this hoaxer, or it's obviously a hoax and this type of thing. And apparently, the individual, after inspecting this, came back and said, sir, look, this is really not a hoax. I'm quite sure this is the genuine thing. And Webber literally broke down crying.
Oh, my.
And he never even saw the crop circle. I read about this in a book, I think, by Freddie Silva, who's one of the crop circle researchers over in Britain. So, I mean, I guess that one story struck me as how many people would this happen to, where when you learn such a vastly revolutionary new truth like this, would it have the capability of just of breaking you down psychologically and really almost damaging you psychologically?
It's easy
for us to say how this would be a growing experience for the human race, and I think we all believe that in the long run it would be, but in the short term, we all have family members, we all have relatives, guys, and we all know people who would not take this revelation very well. So that was one of the things that I was thinking about in my talk.
I was a little disappointed that I wasn't able to see it, although the reason was extremely entertaining to me. Among my other responsibilities was announcing every float and alien and alien pet and guest parade.
Oh, the alien parade. What's going on?
Visualize yourself standing on a dais with judges, with a microphone in your hand, with a stack of 3x5 cards. Everybody and their brother coming by, and the mayor in a nice car with Miss New Mexico's spirit, and then you realize your cards are a little out of order.
Oh, yeah.
And it was extremely entertaining and challenging, and I had a great time, but had that not been an obligation, I would have loved to have heard your talk. You know, you're such a clear thinking explorer of your subject for me, and one lecture evolves very naturally out of another. As you turn a corner, you see a new area of exploration. And this is not just an area of this particular lecture, Problems with Disclosure, that I was just interested in because it's an intellectually challenging topic. It's one that I have been really wrestling with and examining increasingly over the past years. And interestingly, the way things worked out with this conference, and we'll talk about this specifically as we get on a bit later in the show, we had a pair of presenters who presented a decidedly theological approach to the UFO question. And when you came right down to it, what I am used to in terms of pragmatic, historic, scientific, police-type investigations of this work was sort of countermanded by substituting belief and faith for hard evidences. And I think these folks, when I say these folks, I mean across the board. Let's say we have several hundred million people in the world that see their religions, absolutely any religion, as the religion and take their holy books as absolutely literal, that God, in their best way of understanding, took out his giant fountain pen and wrote that book from beginning to end. A challenge in the form of, let's say, something like Ezekiel to the Judeo-Christian tradition.
Well, you know, it might be best for us to back up a little bit there, Peter, and explain to some of the people listening, because they're probably listening thinking, what are you talking about?
Let me back up here, and just to say again, the idea of disclosure has, as you said, many nuanced problems to it. Again, if a president of the United States, and I don't think any one leader would be allowed to, in a sense, or would choose to do this on their own. The way I sort of visualize it sometimes is there would be careful coordination, either through the United Nations or G8 or some other group that, you know, has initials we don't know about, where all world leaders would essentially go on media at the same time and make this announcement. However, in America, if the president did an announcement like this, as you noted, there are associated problems. Namely, it would mean that whether you're liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, when you go and make that announcement, you are saying by implication every single president of the United States and every highest ranking level in the administration has been complicit as co-conspirator in this cover-up.
Yeah.
And that's
so
a problem right off the bat.
Now. You're not, I mean, we were talking about the religious question coming up.
We bounced around a little bit. We're going to come back to the religion.
Okay, I'm just
We're coming back to the religion.
I'm not sure about it, because
back up even more on the question posed to us by Karen was favorite parts of the conference. What did you enjoy the most? And I'll just pose that to you guys first.
Well, my favorite, if I can just jump in.
Yes, you can.
One thing that I loved was meeting all the people who are friends on MySpace. Who use false names or nicknames, and I can certainly understand why somebody would want to do that. But it was really fun to see real people, you know, and have somebody walk up and want to shake my hand and say, "Hi, I'm Darkness."
Oh, how cool!
Hey, cool.
Very,
you know, I didn't even think about that, Karen, but I agree. I think that that was a really nice feature of
the conference. I loved that, because there, you know, there's people I've been emailing for months, and now I got to actually see them and meet them and shake their hands, and it was so great.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I enjoyed that. As with all conferences, I don't know if Roswell this year was completely different, but it was in line, which is there are always engaging, fascinating, really smart people who you get to meet at these places, and who always, like in my case, I have a lot of interesting people that come up to me, and they offer me information, research leads, and the like, and this conference certainly had a few of those individuals as well. And to me, it's like going, it's like Christmas time or at a candy store where I get some free stuff.
Well said.
It's always a treat, and there were a number of very interesting people I got to chat with at Roswell in that regard. Plus, there's just some old friends.
Yeah,
we're good buddies with Guy Malone, and Free and Amy Ward, good friends of ours, and
met
some very really good people organizing the conference at the City of Roswell.
Well,
and I was at the museum because that's always another conference altogether. We went down there and saw Stanton Friedman again,
who's
a fixture at Roswell.
Yes,
obviously, and then Don Schmidt,
Tom Carey,
Kathy Martin, who co-wrote a book with Stan, wrote the Betty Hill abduction case.
Yvonne Smith,
Her
new book.
Yeah, so it was great. Oh, and of course, lest we forget, the great Nina Hagen, German pop icon, was there.
I
got my picture taken with Nina Hagen.
And you couldn't
I will have to post on MySpace.
Yeah.
For all my MySpace friends.
I
have not gotten any pictures.
Oh, by the way, we'll
husband.
Be broadcast all over Germany on November 15th.
And what's that, Peter? Say that again.
Her show will be broadcast in Germany on November 15th.
Cool.
And for those of your listeners that aren't familiar with her, Nina kind of broke in as sort of an avant-garde rocker in the late 70s or so, and has been a highly regarded and rather beloved German eccentric performer ever since, and has she heads up one of the most popular weekly reality television shows in Germany, and was in Roswell to film for an upcoming episode the lighthearted as well as the serious side of this subject. Nina has had a sighting, so she does take the subject seriously, but knows a good visual opportunity when she hears about it. But she brought, I think, 11 technical people who were extremely nice, and the city worked with them very closely, and I think it will come back to the city in a good way.
And Karen loved having those tech people around, didn't you, Karen?
I was standing there very quietly, off to one side. I had my little margarita in my plastic.
Yeah.
It was phenomenal, by the way.
Yeah.
I forget who they said made the margaritas, but
That was the very nice folks from Chili's restaurant in downtown Roswell. Don't miss it when you are there, folks.
Boy, I'll tell you, when I saw that they were handing out mixed drinks in plastic cups, I kind of thought,
that was one of the best
margaritas I've ever had in my life. It was phenomenal.
So I'm
off in a corner, kind of trying to stay out of the way, because there's big crowds, you know, and I just was talking with a couple of people. I got my little drink there. We were happy. And every 2 minutes, there's a camera, like somebody with a camera is nudging us over.
Oh, dear.
You've got to get in here. So I was like, okay.
Sorry about that.
And Karen's thinking, who's this chick in the red dress, first of all?
Well, everybody was thinking, who's this woman in the red dress? With all the
very red dress.
Of course. And, you know, I just started to get annoyed about the fifth time I had to stop my conversation and move over again because of the cameras. It's like, people, come on.
Well, understood.
I thought it was great.
In the world of other celebrities, and I salute the museum for bringing in two iconic film actors, although one of them also with a very distinguished theater career, and that was, our star, co-star of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
You're thinking of 2001, Space Odyssey?
Well, I'm thinking of that too, but Close Encounters, the gal who played opposite...
Yeah.
Dreyfus,
I'm looking up her
whose name I should have right here.
She was at the Roswell Museum, wasn't she?
She was at the museum, which is why her name's not popping right up to the top of her head. Because
and also the name of the guy who played Dave in 2000.
Wallace Stone. Yes, she played the gal who...
he was there.
...child went missing. But yes, Cur Dulay, who many of us remember as astronaut Dave Bowman in 2001... And when I went to the museum a couple of times, actually had a very nice talk with Julie Schuster, the director, and made the rounds and saw all of our friends and acquaintances. But there's Mr. Dulay sitting at his table reading a book, and nobody is going up to him. And I went up to him and introduced myself. I was able to do that fairly efficiently because our pictures were right next to each other in one of the features in the Vision magazine. And said, I don't want to bother you about UFOs, but I work in New York theater as well as doing this, and I have a feeling we probably know some of the same people.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful conversation with him. And in fact, we did work with about 15 of the same people over the years. They were younger when he worked with them than I did. I'll stress that. He's certainly older than me. But I got to ask him a couple of questions about 2001 and they're fair to share here. Number one, Kubrick only gave them little bits and pieces of the script and didn't do it in order. So he really didn't know how this was going to come out. They didn't get to watch more than one or two of the rushes, the daily filmings. And if you remember, his character is quiet almost four-fifths of the entire film. He's either aging or reflecting or looking or thinking.
I remember, yes.
And he said he had no idea how it was going to come together till the opening night and was quite taken aback. And, well, what can you say? He's a charming guy and certainly some interest in UFOs, but very nice to meet an actor of his stature there.
While growing up in my, remember in my early teens, I really was taken with that movie. It was one of those movies where no one in my family really got except me. I remember being 13 years old thinking, this is like one of the greatest movies I've ever seen.
I thought
And of course, I think it has possibly maybe the top five movie scenes of all time. In my opinion, is the very first scene where the apes encounter that monolith.
Yeah.
And it's right there. And then, if you recall, the last moment of that, they throw one of them throws a bone up in the air.
Oh, yeah.
And that changes to the ship, the spaceship, in 2001.
I had asked
him brilliant cut.
What his favorite scene was, knowing that most mediocre actors love watching themselves on screen, and most of the really fine ones always feel a bit self-conscious about doing it, and he immediately said, the whole first part of the film, he doesn't really like watching himself on screen, and that is, yes, from the beginning of the monolith till when the ape throws a bone up in the air, and it transitions, and all of a sudden we're in space. And I said to him, you know, when it becomes the space station. And he said, isn't it funny that so many people remember it like that? It actually cuts to a little ship heading toward the space station, as you remembered.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. He said, though, for him, the ultimate irony was that that spaceship, if you remember the plot, or we rewatch it and refresh our minds, there is a nuclear bomb on that little ship, and it is heading toward the space station, and he thought, what an amazing transition going from this bone, which was sort of the state-of-the-art weapon,
right,
to a nuclear bomb. Anyway, it was a great point of reflection, and bravo to the museum for bringing in those folks. I had the extraordinary experience of being hired by both the conference organizers and the city to assist in the process of putting both of these things together over the past 6 months, and it was so nice to meet the people from the city, from the mayor on down, who had worked so hard for their small city to have this event. I was just really quite moved by all the hard work that had gone into it, and you know, thought they did quite a good job, and salute them and hope they'll continue the good work.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but
That was a nice feature, though. I didn't get to meet him, incidentally.
Oh, well, you will hopefully next time if they let us back into town.
Right.
But yes, very nice people, and I must say one of the most moving aspects for me was watching Paul David's movie, Roswell, on the big screen with an audience in Roswell. As you guys know, the intention had been to screen this movie outdoors following the 4th of July fireworks. And through a number of technical problems, it just didn't pan out. So the next night it was shown at the large venue at the New Mexico Military Institute we were using for our conference. And it was a beautiful print, and I've seen it a number of times, but was very moved to see it with a real audience in a theater. What a great piece of film overall it really is, and focusing in on the human aspect of this story. And poor Jesse Marcel, who was simply following orders and was person charged with releasing this world-shaking...
Good point about Paul David's movie.
Yeah.
Because when you really talk about Roswell, We tend to, at least I often will tend to be very matter-of-fact and journalistic about it. And what Paul did is he brought out the human side.
Just what I was.
This and how it damages somebody's career and life when you're forced to take part in a cover-up.
Unbelievable.
And in Jesse Marcel's case, it made to look kind of foolish.
Yes, oh, very.
Very foolish.
And reverberated for the next 3.5 decades or however much longer.
Right.
It was a laughing stock of people that should have regarded him as a hero. And, it just, you could almost feel it in the audience. Again, this was the hometown crowd, but it was just, I'm very, very impressed with the film, all the more so after seeing it in a large print. But the city was bustling. They certainly had their share of lighthearted stuff, much of it geared for family and for kids. And in discussing this as the genesis of this went forward, their basic idea was, for most people, you know, this is something they don't know much about. It is tied in by circumstance to the 4th of July. So let's have a good time. And there will be a percentage of those people always that will become serious students of the subject. And I think that this is one of those subjects where things change arithmetically rather than geometrically, barring the unforeseen. We'll continue to get 1, 2, 4, 7 people at a time, but it's not kind of a mass movement of the 60s type of thing. People's minds do change one at a time on this, and often slowly.
Yeah, it really struck me in Roswell was the number of people I spoke to, conference attendees, who actually did not know anything about UFOs.
Yes.
They would come up to me and say, so you believe in this?
Yeah.
And I'm just so not used to that, because a lot of the conferences we've been going to lately have been things like the MUFON Symposium.
Sure.
Things where it's gatherings of people who have been researching this for years.
Yes.
And I forgot that it's such a tourist attraction in Roswell as well, and it attracts people for the festival, people who really, they just swing by to see what it's all about.
Yeah,
and so
right.
They're really starting at ground zero.
And I think from my discussions after the fact, because I stayed there until Tuesday, so I had a chance to meet with the mayor and the committee and do a bit of a post-mortem on what worked and what they're thinking about for next year. I'm quite excited by some of the things that I heard at the meeting just this past Monday, and I'm hoping by our next radio show in about a month, I'll be able to discuss them with you guys. And right now, though, I'll just leave the audience hanging and saying I think that based in part on that notion of regular folks who really don't go to these things but might like to find one that worked for them, that the city may be putting forward something rather unusual. And again, we'll hopefully be able to talk about that this month.
Cool.
Before we move on, I think that Karen should maybe give a quick little overview to some of the people listening to the show about what she talked about.
Oh, please.
Because I think you had a very interesting talk, Karen.
Well, thank
that's
you.
Important.
That got very good feedback, and it's on a topic that I think is a quite original area of investigation. And I think there's probably a lot of fruitful and it will bear fruit with more investigation, but you've already come up with some interesting things.
No question. Yes, if you would, Karen.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. I spoke about alien images appearing in TV shows and movies that are aimed at children rather than at adults. And I brought this up for the first time last year at the 2007 Roswell Conference, and all I did then was point out images and say, these look like aliens, and these look like aliens, and, why are they here? And I wonder if it's being done deliberately. And in the year between then and having given this talk this past weekend, I was able to do some research. And a lot of people who heard my talk the first time sent me information, and they sent me the names of books and more cartoons that I should look at. And I actually was able to get some good research done and discovered that, yes, in fact, the CIA did sponsor an education program to try to control the way American citizens think of UFOs and how we view aliens and how much we might be willing to accept them. There were actual definite connections between people who were in the CIA and people who were working in production companies in Hollywood and people who are actually making these animated shows. I found an excellent book that someone told me about, and then he actually sent me his copy. Peter Marsaro, I want to just thank him profusely, my gosh. Not only did he tell me about it, he actually sent me his book and said, here, use this, you know, as long as you need it. And,
what book, Karen?
The book is called Hollywood versus the Aliens.
Oh, great.
And it was Bruce Rucks.
Wonderful book.
It was phenomenal. Mm. It was absolutely invaluable.
No other book like it.
No, nothing. And I just recently heard about some other book that Bruce Rucks has written, and I don't recall the title, but I remember thinking that first one was so well written, I want to check out the next one as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I thought your talk was very well given, though.
Well, thank you.
And
yeah, a couple of technical problems there as well, our video clips. For some reason, Rich worked so hard, and he got those video clips to work, but then when we put them on the new computer for the actual talk...
I felt your frustration, guys. But, and I said as much in my opening and closing, before and after your talk, for me, your work is so valuable and so unique. No one else in the field has really kind of claimed this area of study as their own. And how can anything be more important than raising healthy children that are not at effect of programming and being led or misled instead of thinking for themselves? So this is not just, you know, flattery because we're friends. It was a wonderful talk, and I am glad to restate that even though there were technical problems with the visual materials, this talk will be available through the conference folks, the CE4 people that put this particular conference together.
And they did say that they will be able to put those video clips.
Well, even more, that first they were working with two cameras. It was digital recording, so it will be a very professional editing of, you know, you as a speaker. But rather than what most conferences do, even good ones, where they train the camera on the screen behind us to get the visuals, they will be actually inserting them as first-generation digital material and adding the materials that you weren't able to get to play. So this is one for folks' library. And again, I cannot stress too strongly. I think over, you know, time, Karen, you are going to become such a centrally important person in this area. And I have to say, almost from, it's not even a philosophical point of view as much as just another area of, you know, this is a male-dominated area of study, like, duh, what isn't? And you are, I don't think a guy would have come up with this, in part because it is not men who generally raise children. And you are not only raising your kids, but you're homeschooling them. And I understand they're, just a tad smarter than you two are at this point.
We are.
Fairly sharp.
Get me started on that.
Interesting observers of the universe and trying to control.
Right.
looking forward to meeting them very much. But again, this is terribly exciting to me, and I was even thinking at some point, because we don't live that all far away from each other in New York State. I'm in Ithaca, and you're in Rochester, and if anybody looks at a map, it's a pretty good-sized state. But I have collected in my library over the years quite a good number of books aimed at children on UFOs and related subjects going back to the 50s, but some more contemporary. And at some point, when you guys do come to visit, we can scan an awful lot of imagery for you to take and to percolate with and to use in future presentations. But yeah, keep up the good work. I thought it was a compelling lecture and look forward to your next.
Well, thanks. I was really interested to see how, you know, last year my lecture was all, gosh, has anybody noticed this? Whereas this year it was about mind control and saying, you know what, the CIA is using mind control in our kids. And because it's on cartoons, we're not noticing, and we're not seeing it. And my point really was I wanted to tell parents, you know, this stuff is out there. Pay attention to what your kids are watching on TV and
right.
teach them to think for themselves and to be able to filter this stuff, at least to know it's there.
May I add one thing that I'm pretty sure you mentioned in your talk, and this is the whole thing with the lady Ann Wood, who created the Teletubbies and then the show Boo Bah over at BBC. Anyone who's seen either of those shows, I mean, the E.T. imagery is just screaming from A to Z anytime you watch this. These are a bunch of chubby, cute aliens that, in the case of Teletubbies, they got the underground base. They've got all this remote control stuff. But the thing is, there was that interview when you were researching this, Karen, mm-hmm. Where you found this interview of Ann Wood. And the thing about it, remember, was she talked about everything but ETs. Everything but UFOs.
She certainly never brought it up. None of the questions that she was asked ever brought it up. And to us, it seems like such an obvious question.
it's
the boobas, especially, they show up in a UFO. I mean, what is that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But she avoided it as if, it was screaming by its absence. It was just this amazing omission.
But the interesting thing, one thing that really caught my eye was that when I noticed this years ago, remember I used to try to get you to talk about this, Rich, and you were
right.
busy, you know, with other topics. But I would talk about it at conferences. I'd take people aside and say, well, did you ever see this Teletubbies thing? And they didn't know what I meant because they didn't
yeah.
watch Teletubbies.
Right, right.
They didn't have kids at home.
For a while it was only available in England as well.
Right. Well, even after it was here, I never talked with people at conferences who had small children at home who had these shows on their TVs. And then I would talk about it with my friends here in Rochester who had little kids, and they weren't reading the UFO books. They didn't see the similarities between Teletubbies and the aliens, or they weren't struck by the whole UFO imagery yeah. in Boo Bah because they
weren't familiar with it.
They didn't have the UFO reference.
Sure.
So that was why I felt that it was really interesting and important to bring out, because it seemed to be something that I had noticed that not a lot of other people had the opportunity
yeah,
to.
I think that's right.
And it reminds me of a wonderful phrase by the late Dr. Wilhelm Reich, which was evasion of the obvious. For those of us that are studied in this area,
yes.
right between the eyes, there is nothing else it relates to. And as an aside to one of your comments during your lecture, Karen, I can't stand those Bratz characters either. I think
thank you.
Objectionable on every single level, and they're doubly unnerving because you take away the hair and the eye makeup, and the facial proportions are very archetypically gray. But
mm-hmm.
it's like, well, you know, to be blunt, it's like, you know, 11-year-old prostitutes sort of.
Well, that too.
Terrible
I know
depiction.
That was what bothered me at first, and
then
I realized
superficial little idiots, and I just find them abhorrent. They make poor Barbie look like a Nobel Prize winner.
They do.
Well,
like the poor smart girl that nobody wants to talk
yeah.
to.
they are really appropriate symbols of the total trashing of American culture in general.
I
hate to say it, but...
on it, Rich. Exactly so.
It's like American culture has become trash city. How people dress...
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just becoming old-fashioned. I am.
Well,
getting up there.
A lot of younger people are... genuinely interested in what Paris Hilton or Lindsay Lohan, who used to be quite an accomplished actress before she just became a professional jerk, are interested in doing. I think also this is being rammed down our throats by a media that is more than happy to be complicit with the government in having any number of idiotic distractions, shiny little objects to say, look here, when the world is going to hell on a handcart. And unfortunately, I think we will see more of this as the world continues to dumb down and foxify, to create a phrase.
On that note, we need to take a bit of a break, and we can jump right back into this when we come back. We will be back in a few minutes. For those of you who are just joining, you're listening to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. We are going to take a few minutes. We will be back shortly, and I will be talking some more with Rich Dolan and Peter Robbins. Right now, we're discussing UFOs in the news, specifically our experiences at the Roswell UFO Festival last week. Don't go too far. We'll be back in a minute. excited to hear that we're going to be doing this regularly.
All right. Direct the conversation as thy will, O hostess. And again, I meant that. I'm actually looking at part of my bookshelf now of all these kids' books and thinking, this is made for you. They cut across everything, and they do go back to the 50s, and it's so much raw material that you can develop from. And I do want to get you guys down here at some point before the winter sets in.
Oh, we'd love to come down. Ithaca is beautiful.
Have a wonderful long time and work out the logistics. And if you want to bring the kids, I'm sure we can work that out as well. If not, you know, we can stay up later and speak rudely and whatever.
Okay.
Are we on yet?
Speaking of speaking rudely, yeah, I did just check. Thanks so much, Joe, for letting us know.
I thought I heard the music.
Things are getting a little. I did hear the music, and then I heard it stop, and I wasn't sure what was going on. So things are a little funky tonight. We are back. Welcome back, everyone who has been listening to Through the Keyhole. Apparently, we took a very short break this evening, and probably because we started a bit late, which was due to my not letting my producer know that I was back from Roswell. So things are a little crazy. He's laughing. Everything's fine. But yes, we are back on the air. This is Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan. My guests tonight are Peter Robbins and Rich Dolan. And we were talking about UFOs in the news, beginning with the Roswell UFO Festival, which we all attended last week. And we've been having a great time just chatting about the festival and how much fun we all had there.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, we were, and I just went completely blank on where we stopped at the break.
Well,
there was something we were saying, we were just getting into a really great point, and we were saying, pick that up again.
Well, we were talking about the grave indiscretion over the break by Mr. Jesse Jackson regarding Obama.
And I'm not.
And that is because we were wondering if we were saying anything bad over the break that anyone was listening to.
I can only advise your listeners that are not aware of the situation to simply go online and find it. Mr. Jackson, a very articulate and charismatic speaker in his own right, thought his microphone was off and said some things that were inappropriate. And
I'm excited now. I want to go find out what this was.
You're on the air. When in doubt, just be quiet.
Yeah.
I mean, not that we are media experts. We would never pretend that we are. But we've all done radio. We've all been on and off the air, and it's sometimes you don't know. And look, when you're speaking publicly, if you do it with any amount of any for any length of time, you put on a public face.
Yes.
And it doesn't mean it's a fake face. It's not the same thing. But you have to realize, I mean, and everyone listening, I'm sure, realizes that when you let your guard down in private, that's one thing. And when you are speaking and you know that thousands or millions, in Jesse Jackson's case, people that might be listening to you, you've got to be very careful. And it's kind of a game. Everyone knows it. But when you screw up at that game, that's when you get roasted alive.
Well, then everybody really knows it.
You know, but stay in the same topic for a moment. Thursday, which was the 3rd of July, very early in the morning, myself and other people involved with the conference woke up at 3 o'clock so that we could be part of the CBS morning show, which, of course, is 2 hours earlier than it would be broadcast in New York. And as you might expect, they wanted to do the usual puff pieces and the silly stuff. And so they had 100-plus people turn out from the town and costume and, you know, masks and T-shirts and all that. And it's pitch blackout. And they're filming away and, you know, keeping it very lighthearted. And as the conference coordinator and the city's media liaison person, I was called upon to be the quote-unquote serious interview.
Okay.
And as you guys know, when you do something for television, if it's a documentary or a show that's being filmed and later broadcast, it's sort of a different psychology. Not that if you screw up it'll still look bad, but there is something about doing live television, especially a show like the early show on CBS, where you know, in fact, at least 3 million people will be watching as you speak. And it was an interesting experience for me and a bit of an object lesson. The front guy, Dave Price, I'll say his name, he travels around the country part of the time in a big van with his picture on it and does these innately American hometown pieces and puff pieces. And when he's in New York, he covers the weather. His producer told me I'll be on camera with him for anywhere between 1.5 and 2, maybe a little more, minutes, and to grab the time that I can and to do my best to keep it serious, because his basic job is not necessarily to cover it in a serious way. Well, about 20 minutes before I'm supposed to go on with him, and I'm looking like an investment banker, I like to give them as small a target as possible to look at, and I'm mic'd up, and his producer says, you might as well just meet him right now, and walks me over, and hi, where are you from? New York. Oh, where do you live now? Oh, upstate New York. Where upstate? Oh, near Ithaca. And all of a sudden, he looks right at me, and he's in real contact now. He said, where near Ithaca? I said, Enfield. He said, where in Enfield?
Oh, boy.
Smiled. He said, I'm a Cornell graduate. Let's talk. Cornell, of course, is in Ithaca.
Cool.
All of a sudden, he is a real human being, and smart and nice. We go into his trailer, he closes the door, and we talk for 15 minutes.
Wow, that's great.
What he said in so many words was, look, I've got a job here. You know, we've just done the lighthearted thing. I know there's a serious aspect to this, but like most people, I'm not very studied in it. Tell me what I should ask you to elicit some intelligent, compelling answers.
Wow,
and his producer
great.
Joined us, and again, I was on camera only for about 2 minutes with all of the assembled multitude in costume in backdrop, but we kept that 2 minutes serious. And even though he had a green shirt on with alien pictures on his suspenders, I had to salute him because this is not fun or the easiest thing to cover, and he did it with a certain amount of class and gave me an opportunity to end on a favorite high note, which was paraphrasing Stanton Friedman's wonderful thought that the question is not, are UFOs representative of advanced technology from places unknown, you know, coming and going with impunity? The question is, has one ever been? And the overwhelming answer to that is yes. And that was the note we ended on, which, of course, also delighted our friend Stanton Friedman.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
Good story.
Cool.
The public loves it.
Yeah.
We approve.
And we were just getting into, as we went to break, you and I both have other conferences coming up very shortly. You, the MUFON conference, and that's the big national one. And I'll be speaking as the lone token UFO speaker at a paranormal conference coming up in Clearwater, Florida on the 19th and 20th called the TAPS conference, TAPSCon.com if you want to look it up. And speaking on the Rendlesham Forest incident, but you had just mentioned an interesting break in the Stevensville, Texas case, and I wish you would pick that up for me and for the rest of our listening audience.
Before we do that, I would like to jump in because I have a couple of people on the message board who have been waiting patiently to ask questions.
Your show, and they're your guests. Let's give them priority.
I don't want to keep them waiting too much longer.
Yeah.
I would like to
talk
about the Stevensville thing, and there is more we want to talk about the Roswell conference as well.
Mm.
But Dee has had her hand up for a really long time. She's been amazingly patient, and I would like to hear what her question is. Of course, I'm going to have to rely on my producer now, who appears to be playing trickster with me this evening. So,
yeah.
Joe, can we take Dee's question?
He's in the bathroom.
I don't See, I don't understand the intricacies of the message board here. She's had her hand up for quite a while.
Well, we can field her question. You know, there's some interesting news about Stevensville, which...
Oh, wait.
We have her.
Dee? I can just barely hear her voice. Is that Dee asking a question?
Who had told her that in fact I'm sorry, I have to break in because I really can't hear you. Joe, if there's anything we can do to make this louder,
I can't hear
you.
Can
you speak up? I can just make out the word commercial advertising, but I don't know.
She's talking about children. I think she's talking about your theme.
Okay.
The possibility of this educational program, not just for children, but for adults as well. Thank you.
Dee, I don't think we could hear that very well. I'm very sorry. It didn't come through.
I couldn't hear the question at all.
I know she had an insight about, I think the theme that you were discussing last week, if I'm not mistaken, Karen, that is the idea of alien imagery in children's programming, but I couldn't get any of the specifics.
Yeah.
Possibly the listeners were able to hear it better than we did. That does happen sometimes.
Yeah, see, if you could type it onto the message board. I've got the message board open, and I would be able to read it, but
yeah.
I don't know what happened there with the audio. I was not able to hear the question at all.
I wonder if I could just mention, there's a very interesting news item that has just come out, and this is a notice from MUFON regarding the Stevensville UFO sighting. And unless you've been living in a cave without electricity for the last 5-6 months, then you will know a very important UFO sighting occurred over central Texas, in primarily over the town of Stevensville, in January of this year. And now this involved no less than 50 eyewitnesses who said they saw this enormous object. One person described it as large as one of those Walmart supercenters. So can you imagine a flying Walmart? Of course, let's face it, when Walmarts start to fly, I'm out of here. But be that as it may, this was an enormous object zooming across the sky, low, silent, being chased by a bunch of F-16s. The Air Force originally said, that's absurd, they probably saw some reflection off of commercial airliners. The witnesses said, sure, right. Well, eventually the Air Force was forced to admit that there were F-16s on a so-called training mission in the area. But, of course, there was no confirmation that there was official confirmation that there was an unknown object. Now, here's the thing. MUFON, Mutual UFO Network, petitioned the FAA for National Weather Service, here we go, for any kind of radar trackings of unknown objects over or near Stephenville, Texas on January 8, 2008. And guess what? They received radar data through Freedom of Information that confirmed that an unknown flying objects, plural, listen to this, were on a direct course to President Bush's Crawford Ranch and were separate from the known F-16 jets that
wow.
the same radar data
Whoa.
Confirmed were flying the same night. That's right.
Nice.
Okay? So FAA and National Weather Service tracked unknowns directly in that area. That's Stephenville. Very close.
So that was recent. So
it was the same. It was the day of the Stephenville sighting. I mean, we had radar confirmation.
Right. So for any listeners who maybe had not heard of the Stephenville sighting, when was that? That was
January 8th, 2008.
Okay, January 2008. So you think they wanted to discuss the election?
Who knows? Well, this will be discussed, on Larry King tonight. Larry King's doing a piece which will involve Stephenville. A bunch of the witnesses will be there. I certainly hope, that this radar tracking news will be there. MUFON has announced it at their forthcoming conference in San Jose later this month. They will be making a major press conference with media there and everything. But they've already released the information. So I consider this really the most significant UFO data of 2008 so far. And the reason being that, I mean, there are lots of good UFO sightings out there that are legitimate, but it's very difficult, especially these days, to be able to obtain official government,
vetted data that supports a visual sighting. In this case, we've got, apparently, from FAA and National Weather Service, two sets of records indicating that there were unknown objects in that area. So that's really quite important. Whether it's really going to make much of the wave, an impact in the mainstream news, I wonder. Had this been available in January, I think it would have had much greater impact. But nonetheless, it could, mm-hmm. it could make some hay, especially if Larry King does anything with it tonight.
And the fact is, it is now on record, making this a much more viable incident to point Mr. and Mrs. John Q. Public toward as
right.
real, in quotes. I remember how exciting it was for me at a point in researching and investigating the Rendlesham Forest incident in England for the book Left at East Gate to get hold of a copy of a letter from then Secretary for Defense Michael Hazeltine in 1983
right.
Telling a constituent that there was no UFO incident, there were no aliens, and in this letter on Ministry of Defense letterhead that certainly there were no radar reports to confirm it. And then a letter that I later got hold of to Nick Redfern, our good friend and colleague, confirming that, yes, of course, they had radar returns, but that all those records had been destroyed. But that feeling of being able to triangulate with real hard information on an incident that most people
yeah.
think of as ethereal or gossamery or allegorical or just not
it's
real.
Concrete. It's real.
It's a coup. It's always a coup.
No.
So that's great news.
Well, what amazed me about this particular bit of news is that the FAA wasn't playing games again. I mean, the FAA has a long history of just blowing people off. Back in the early 1980s, in New York State, where we, the three, happened to be, in lower New York State, just above New York City, in what is known as the Hudson Valley, there were enormous numbers of sightings of
indeed.
Boomerangs and triangles and just large flying saucer-type objects. People saw it in huge numbers, and the FAA was really playing point, doing damage control, denying
yeah.
that there was anything going on. And their job was really to lie, I feel, to the public, maybe to prevent panic, but lie they did. They've done this ever since. They've never wavered until very recently. Even as recent as the O'Hare case of 2006,
yeah.
the FAA was busy lying to the public, saying, oh, no, we have no information. And then they were caught flat out in their lie.
Yeah.
When reporter John Hilkovich did some investigation and proved them wrong, that they did have the data that this object was there. So the FAA, now in this case, apparently has released data that is confirming UFO. And every now and then also you get this sense from within the FAA that there are unhappy people there, that they actually
definitely didn't fight
it. Want to talk, and that they're hampered by official sanctions. And so
I think that actually is going on at a number of levels of intelligence and government relative to UFOs in the big picture, even whatever the residual working group is now, whatever they call itself, that began as the MJ-12 working group, or
right.
again, however we want to characterize it. I think there it's rife with infighting, that there are those among the teams that must be saying enough already. You know, sooner or later,
more. I think that's exactly right.
In our face. And the old guard.
The information that I get every now and then, I run into people who seem like they've got a clue as to what's going on the inside. And this the sense you get that there are many good people who believe in the ideals. I think that most of us listening believe
yeah.
in, which is truth and justice and. But they have been constrained professionally from talking about it, and they're not happy about it. And so it's a struggle that goes on. It's not as if, the decision is made and that's it forever.
And
things are always in flux. Matters are always in flux because our world is constantly changing.
Yeah.
This isn't the 1990s. It's not the 1980s, and the world will continue to be different.
And I think now that, this most oppressive regime is in its descendancy and very much lame duck, I think everybody can admit that we have not had a more secrecy-obsessed administration, certainly in modern history, I think all history. And whatever happens with whomever comes after Mr. Bush and company, I cannot imagine that the mania for secrecy will be quite at the pitch that it's been. But you brought up a very interesting point with the Westchester overflights. I was part of a big town meeting there at the height of this in 1983.
It was in the local high school. Is that the one you're talking about, Peter?
84, yes, exactly.
Yeah, I only wrote about it from my next book, so I want to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, it drew absolutely everyone. In fact, it was the one time that I got to meet Dr. Alan Hynek.
Yes, he was there.
Bud was there. It was a remarkable town hall type meeting where hundreds of people from the community attended and a smattering of people from the field, and dozens of them, one after the other, got up on this big high school stage and said, you know, I'm a housewife, I'm a horse breeder, I deliver newspapers, I do this, that, or the other thing. They came over my property. This was also, we're somewhat into the video revolution at this point, so many of these folks had filmed it. And they showed clip after clip. They had witness after witness. And, of course, the newspapers are making it seem like these people are silly, goofy, hallucinating cultists. But, in fact, you never saw a more real bunch of people who gave two hecks about the ridicule factor. They were angry. They were curious. They were fascinated. They wanted to know what was going on.
Peter, did you just say two hecks?
I did. I was going to say... can I say hell? And then,
as in the eternal damnation of hex.
Now it is.
Right, I just want to make sure that's what I heard. Okay.
It was, and now it's a curious hybrid word with some a certain precedent right there. I expect everybody.
That's what I was thinking. So yes.
Am I the only one here who wants to see a documentary made now with the title of Being John Hillkovich?
Oh, wow.
I think it's now three of us.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it could be about the journalists who break the stories. Wouldn't that be cool?
Well, the dude's never followed up, so, I mean, he had a great story.
He broke
picked up on another tangent. That wonderful female reporter that covered the Stevensville... Excellent, because Alejandro Rojas, I don't know if you heard his talk. He is, of course, the head of MUFON Public Education. And a wonderful guy, I think, a real up-and-comer in our field.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
He gave a terrific presentation, and he touched on something I wasn't aware of. I knew that this gal, and we've seen it before, lost her job as a reporter for this paper for taking it too seriously. What I was not aware of was she decided to...
This is what she did. She wrote about it in a serious way. She did not debunk it. She was told... to treat it a little more humorously.
It's a puff piece. It's flying saucers for God. Lighten up. But she has now become a full-time UFO investigative writer, and we welcome her to the field. So there's a case of life tosses you a lemon, and I think this woman is going to make some lemonade, and I have so much respect for anybody that will put their job on the line for something like this and maybe turn a corner and become an important contributor to this work. She is a trained journalist. I welcome her aboard, and we'll be tuning in Larry King after our show to hear what she has to say.
We did, by the way, get that question from V.
Oh,
well, good.
It does have to do with the media, so it sort of fits in with what we're talking about here. She said, in regard to Jenny Randall's book, The UFO Conspiracy.
Oh, yes.
Jenny Randall talks about a person who she refers to as, quote, a source in the House of Lords, who told her that there was an education program designed to educate the general public on the subject of UFOs and aliens. She mentions, Dee says in her question, I see that not only is some of the material directed to children, but also to adults in commercials on TV, radio, and billboards. She wanted to know what the three of us think about that. I did across some mention of this when I was researching my own topic, but I didn't discuss that because I was focusing on children.
Yeah.
But Peter, I know you gave a presentation last November at the Crash Retrieval Conference on alien images in advertisements that were geared toward adults.
Well, I think this is the Dee that I know, and if it is, hi Dee, who is in the Southwest in Arizona, and also is a radio host of a show called Eye to the Sky. And while you were speaking, I took my copy of the UFO Conspiracy down from my shelf and have been flipping through it.
One of the first UFO books I ever owned.
Oh, for goodness sakes. Well, Jenny, of course, was an important personage in the work for me because she was co-author of Sky Crash, which was the first book on the Rendlesham Forest incident. And, in fact, I'm going to reread this book because that's a very important reminder that, in fact, these programs were going on in the United Kingdom. And I think it's fair to deduce that probably here in a very quietly organized way, and with good cause. Get those little minds when they're young, and, you know, put whatever programming you want relative to the UFO subject in question, either to misdirect them, confound them, or just make them believe what you want them to believe about it.
Well, I think her point is very well taken, that, you know, mind control within the media, it's to be directed against children, it's to be directed against adults as well, of course. And, you know, with an organization like the CIA, lest someone really, really is, just refuses to believe, let's just put it right on the table. There's been a lot of work done on the relationship between the CIA and mainstream corporations, large corporations, relationship of the CIA with academia, the relationship of the CIA to media. It's been understood by scholars in those fields for many, many years. It's not that the CIA controls everything that comes out of television or comes out of the university setting, but what they do is they have a way of influencing, think of it as knowledge choke points. So, for example, think of the academic example. It's the same, really, as the media. CIA will have people at Harvard, they'll have them at Yale, most definitely Princeton and elsewhere, who are basically covertly, and sometimes not so covertly, working for them, working on their behalf. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means when books come out to be reviewed, that these influential people do the reviews, they set the tone in the field. So if some professor at some local community college wants to rail against the system, you know, frankly, it doesn't matter in terms of the big picture, in terms of the power structure, because the choke points, the powerful people within that field, control the discourse. And it's the same with media. CIA has had an ability for 60 years, and that's not an exaggeration. Right from the beginning of its creation, the CIA has taken it as a given that they are able to influence and propagandize through television and mainstream radio, and it's what they do. And it's not only the CIA. This, I can guarantee you, this goes on in all nations or all major nations of the world, where there's an intelligence community that wants to manipulate its people. It's what they do. They do it because they can do it.
Yeah.
And so the TV media, a diehard skeptic would say, well, yeah, but this is the corporate, you know, they make their decisions based on profit. But it's not always that simple. When you look at the people who run these major corporations, often you find that they have long-standing backgrounds in the intelligence community. Even something as supposedly liberal as National Public Radio, for many years in the 1990s, NPR's news was run by a former CIA propaganda chief, and that is a fact. So it goes everywhere. It's the so-called liberals, it's the so-called conservatives. Intelligence operatives manage both ends of that spectrum, and it's why they're so effective, because they give you the illusion that you're choosing between these two, you know, examples, these two choices, when in fact both choices are pre-selected. And they do, you know, they have, through the Robertson panel, which you referred to, Karen, from 1953, the CIA made an explicit decision that they were going to manage the UFO ET issue through the media. And it was a multi-pronged effort. You can't do it overnight. You have to work it over the years. It evolves. They do it through television commercials, through movies, you know, all forms of media.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'd
it's
like
a way of influencing opinion.
I'd like to look at that Jenny Randall's book a bit more and do some more research in that area, because she's in the UK and Anne Wood is in the UK, and I might be able to find some connection between
mm-hmm.
the
Very good point. Yeah.
Connection here, but Jenny Randall's might have some more leads on.
Yeah, we have that book. I'm looking right at it on my shelf.
Yeah, you
it's
have
a good book. Yeah.
Jenny, I must say, is certainly one of the most prolific writers in the field. I think she's written 843 UFO and paranormal books right now. It turns out one every week or so. She really is unbelievably prolific. I'm joking, of course, but I don't know how many books she's written. And
She has a lot. It's true. A lot of stuff out there. I've read some of her books, but there's just so many. God, you can't keep up.
That's right.
That's the problem with the information age. You know, it's so much there. How does one keep up?
Well, the wonderful Strand Bookstore, where we go to commune with the greater spirits, sells a button. I've seen variations on it. So many books, so little time.
Yeah, we have a poster. Well, very small, like a card in our on the wall in our kitchen that says, "When I have a little money, I buy books. If I have any left over, I buy food and clothing."
All right. Amen.
That's really
how that's from Erasmus of Rotterdam.
Yeah.
Said that.
I think most of us could build a small shelter with our books and stay inside with good protection from a post-nuclear blast.
Yeah, that's true.
Indeed. Hey, Peter, I wonder if, we've been speaking of England and Rendlesham and so on. There's a wave going on in Britain right now, a wave of UFO sightings. Have you been up on this at all? Have you been...
I have only been aware of it in the abstract. I have been so focused in on what has become literally a full-time plus job over the past 6 weeks or so that I have not followed up on the specifics. But, yes.
Well, it's understandable. I find myself in the same position because I'm trying to finish my next book, and I'm in the late 1980s. So I'm living half my life 20 years ago, and the other half I'm trying to keep track on current things.
So ironic that you bring up Rendlesham, though. I had approached the city on a personal project in the middle of all of the stuff I was working on for them. I have a particular affection for libraries, local libraries. I think we are more and more entering a time where especially young people have no sense of reading for pleasure, and those of us that do read as a part of our business life, so to say, as a part of our research, often, forget sometimes that there is this wonderful world of reading for adventure, excitement, for our own satisfaction. And so I contacted the Roswell Public Library and asked them if they would be interested in my doing a little fundraiser. And that is just what I did on Monday. I did a reading from Left at East Gate, talked about the case, gave some updates, talked about essentially how I got involved as a writer and somebody who has followed a more or less adventurous path, starting in my village library in Rockville Center, Long Island, as a particularly short and skinny little kid with glasses.
Did you grow up in Long Island, Peter?
Yeah, well, I right next to you, buddy. I was in Rockville Center, you were in Valley Stream. We're Luntzmen. We're definitely... connected at the hip as far as our Nassau County childhoods go.
I grew up in Suffolk County. My dad lives in Valley Street.
Oh.
I grew up in Brentwood, which is a little farther
out
on the island, but still.
It's over the border
Long
there.
Long Island boy, yeah.
But I gave this talk, and we sold some books, made some money for the library. And it's a variation of experiences that you have. The night before, guy comes up to me, a Roswell resident, former military, former Air Force, obviously wanted to talk, but not in front of other people, and chatted briefly, and then Monday night after the talk, he and his wife had come, he took her home, and then came out to dinner with us, but the two of us were kind of cloistered. He not only was stationed at RAF Bentwaters from 1977 until just a few months before the incident in 1980, he knew quite a number of the players. And the job that he had on that base was, well, it was so, I've never met anybody working in that position, and all I can and will say was he had a unique view of this from a highly, highly secure position within his...
Now, he left just before the event?
He did. That took place in December. He was out about 4 months earlier. Not to say that he didn't have some remarkable things that he could report from his own time on this base, and again having some very interesting character observations about a number of the key witnesses and base personnel.
I see.
It actually shook me up, some of the things he told me, and with really important cases, I don't know if we, well, we never really learn the full picture. We just keep getting it in bits and pieces, as I have for another 12 years now since the book was, well, another 11 years since the book was published in the UK. And, you know, it remains for me the most compelling UFO incident that we could go to court with, even more than Roswell, only because it's more contemporary and we have living witnesses and a much better paper trail and physical evidences and the like. But
I agree, it's one of the all-time excellent cases, without a doubt. Hey, before we go further,
yeah,
do we want to talk about the issue from last week's Roswell? Do we want to get into that?
I think we should. We told our audience we would, and it's
well,
an important note.
Yeah, I think we should. I mean,
yeah.
That is,
so let's do it.
That's big news in this field.
Who wants to introduce it? Karen,
well,
Peter?
I would like to bring it up, actually.
Yeah, the fact is that I was the moderator of this conference. I, as you noted, announced all of the speakers. I oversaw the panel discussion at the end. I had some concerns just from what I understood about this presentation. And have to say, in my more than 25 years as a public speaker on the subject, I have never really heard a fully theologically based this particular aspect of Christian perspective on the subject of UFOs. And
Karen? Okay, so for the people who are listening to us right now who were not in Roswell and don't have any idea what we're talking about, on the second day of our conference, or actually the third day, on Sunday,
sure,
most of the conference presentations seem to have a theological bent, particularly Joe Jordan's and Dave Rufino's presentation.
Yeah.
And what they were presenting was something that they say they have come across in their research, which is that when abductees are in the middle of an abduction experience, or when one is happening, they have found some success with calling on Jesus Christ to stop the abduction. They say that they have had a great deal of the success. Joe told me that they've had something like 300 cases in which this has worked. This has actually stopped it. The problem that I have with this is that they don't seem to allow for any possibility that it ever wouldn't work. Or, as you brought up, Peter, during the panel discussion, there's this implication that if someone tries it and it doesn't work, it's like that person is not a good enough Christian. And it's leaving out the question completely over what if you're not a Christian at all.
I think to a degree, those of us that I will have to characterize in our presentations as the secularists, because they began their talk, Joe Jordan and David Rufino, in a rather dramatic way. They showed a photograph on screen of a courtroom and referred to themselves as the prosecution, making us the defendants, the secularists, so to say. And I had problems with, number one, that this was absolute, that it wasn't just what they saw as one of a number of things that could represent this phenomena, but in fact, the rest of us were off on the wrong trail. I also, as you remember, when I finally posed some questions, and I felt myself in a bit of a rough spot, because as the moderator, I see my job, in any of us would in a panel discussion, to remain scrupulously objective, but all of a sudden you find that you are absolutely not. So I thought I should add my comments at the end, decided not to, because they wouldn't have a chance to respond, and added them about two-thirds of the way through. I'll make my point and turn it back to you guys, but essentially it was, we saw people come on that stage and testify in so many words by their presence that they were abductees, and I thought it took courage, as we all know, to put yourself in that spot in a public forum, but I'm from Missouri on this. Somebody's word is simply not enough. I need to have something to back it up, or to see it in terms of conventional abduction-related research. For example, did any of these people have scars on their body that they couldn't account for? Did any kind of story from childhood involve their disappearing? Did they have a pathological fear of staring at two fried eggs in a pan? Or
yeah, exactly. They, yeah. None of this was really brought out scientifically.
Exactly.
And, you know, you have to vet these folks. Again, I salute them for their courage. They may all be absolutely authentic, but they may not. And, again, we're tippy-toeing around here because religion is involved, and I think that constrained a number of folks in the audience from putting forward questions, as well as some of our colleagues really saying what they thought and felt. At the same time, I thought, well, this is a great opportunity to air this, and for many of us, it was our first chance to really discuss this matter, and I look forward to picking up this dialogue in future. It's something that we should not be pussyfooting around because a lot of people take it seriously, and as such, it should be addressed in an open, honest manner.
Well, as I recall, I'm trying to remember what I said, but one thing was that it was a fallacy when Joe presented their data as something that was replicated scientifically.
Yeah.
In other words, what he was saying is that there were a number of people who claimed that calling upon Jesus on the authority of Jesus Christ prevented abduction. But that's not replication, and there's not a single scientist who would agree that counts as replication.
Yeah.
These are claims.
Very important.
Means that you actually run something through a very specific series of protocols and tests, and that was obviously not done. So it's a misrepresentation of replication. Secondly, there are known cases of people who have had abduction experiences who are devoutly Christian.
Viewed a number of them over the years with Bud,
who have called. And then the other thing I remember saying is that at least when you're in the middle of an abduction experience, the ones that I know of, look, you know, people, you're driving along, you're doing something, whatever it is, and the next thing you know, you've got missing time. Okay? These other beings, they have got the ability to do things. They are out of our league for the most part, I really think.
Yep.
They are operating on a different level. This idea of stopping the abduction. Now, in fairness, I will have to say that I will read the data that they put on their site. I think I would owe them that much, since I did publicly take issue with what they said. So I will do that. And I'll tell you this, if they have things in there that I'm persuaded by that they've got, I have no problem publicly in saying so.
Absolutely, it's something that should be considered. I would have felt much more comfortable if they had presented it in terms of, you know, here's something that we've come across that has worked for a large number of people.
Right, in
think there should be some more study done in this area, and people who are having these experiences should be made aware of this as a possible thing to try, because it has worked for some people in the past. But the way it was presented was very much, very dogmatic. It was really implying that if you try this and it doesn't work, it's your fault.
Right.
And again, that all of us have been pursuing every lead imaginable over the past 61 years have simply been off on false trails. What this is signs and portends of the end times as predicted in the Book of Revelations. These are all these UFOs, and the beings are demonic. They're all deviltry and minions of the devil. And hey, who am I to say it's not true? But that for me to have the intellectual, and I have to use the word arrogance, to say you know that this is true. Again, for me, I kept flashing back to the final question that was asked in last year's discussion panel in Roswell, which sent me into a rather frantic place in responding, which was, why is it that all aliens fear the spoken name of Jesus?
Right.
All I could think was, how can any of us presume to know what's in the mind of another person, as opposed to an alien, as opposed to all aliens?
Yeah.
I think that was a setup question, about that.
You all have been, but it sparked some good dialogue, as this presentation did in itself.
Yeah.
But Karen?
I have to give Guy Malone a lot of credit. When he was running the panel discussion last year, when that question came up, he even said, before he would read it to us, he said, I have to say that I take exception to this.
I appreciate
it. And Guy is a very, very devout Christian himself, and I really admired the fact that he was, he didn't want to just present it as, you know, confirming his own religious beliefs and imposing them on everyone.
Yeah, and I think all of us are open-minded and respectful of anyone's beliefs and would fight to protect them. And if even if it was somebody in a decidedly secular or scientific presentation saying what I have discovered in my work is not a truth or a possible truth or an explanation or something we should consider or something I believe is true, the difference between that and saying this is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
All other points of view are
I have a question on the message board here.
I think a great dialogue and one that we will obviously be engaged in on and off for the rest of our careers. And I also will be reading those comments online because formulate good points of discussion or be fair to our colleagues' points when we disagree with them if we're not really educated to them. So that's our homework assignment.
Yeah.
Okay. Karen?
Well, there's a question on the message board which I'm not able to answer, and I want to pass it on to you, gentlemen. It's concerning the CE4 organization altogether. I'm more familiar with MUFON and how it's set up. Someone is asking, how does the CE4 organization differ from MUFON, and what qualifications does this organization have to determine whether a person who's claiming to be an abductee really is? Do they use the same criteria that MUFON does?
Well, that's a very good question. I have visited their website, and I did not see anything. There may be something there I missed, certainly.
They're not officially affiliated with MUFON. Let me put it this way. There are members in CE4 who are members of MUFON, but I've never gotten this feeling.
But organizations are not...
Right.
Not officially affiliated with each other.
On the other hand, MUFON has not disavowed them either. I looked into this as well last weekend because I wanted. But one of the things that struck me was the emphasis that the CE4 membership set on their connection with MUFON. And I thought, you know, MUFON is the organization that, along with CUFOS, prided itself on what they call scientific ufology. And I have to wonder some of the MUFON members who really created that organization, how would they feel about these types of essentially evangelically based presentations on UFOs? And I suspect they would not agree with a lot of it.
Well,
but MUFON has not taken a position on this, to my knowledge.
I would agree with you, and the main thing I think for CE4 is that it is faith-based.
Right.
Findings and
that's what I was wondering.
Involves belief as opposed to evidence, what I would call evidence, with all due respect to what they present as evidence.
Okay. On that note, gentlemen, unfortunately, we have run out of time. And I can't believe this blew by so quickly. Of course, partly because, you know, I caused that little awkwardness at the beginning of the hour.
Yeah, Karen.
But, sorry about that.
And mine,
Did you hear what happened there, Peter? I forgot to let Joe know that we were doing the show this evening, and
I love it.
He thought we were still in Roswell. So, oops.
Yeah,
sorry. But
thank
we won't
you,
do
Joe.
That again. I will be more careful. Thanks everyone so much for listening, and thank you for joining us, Peter and Rich. It's always a pleasure talking with you too. And
I'll look forward to joining
month.
You again next month and on into the future.
Absolutely.
I think we had a nice time, and I hope everyone enjoyed listening.
Amen to that. And listen, great luck, and have a wonderful time out in California at the MUFON conference. We'll look forward to hearing all about it in the future, and travel safely, and see you guys around the campus.
Actually, do you want to tell them, Rich?
we will not be at MUFON. Yeah, we will not be there.
But we are not planning to speak. We haven't been invited out. And
somebody crazy? They're having a conference and you're not being hired to speak?
I know. How dare they?
Excuse me. I'm going to be making some calls. And
I'll be there. I'm ready, boy. Okay, we need to end this. So I'm so sorry because I'm having such a great time. Thanks, everyone, so much for listening. This has been Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network and on UPRN 105.8 FM in New Orleans. Archives are available at ParanormalRadioNetwork.com and also on iTunes. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and stay tuned for Portal coming up next with Tuesday Miles and Angela Thomas. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.